We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The news media are in transition and times are tough. Digital technology has changed and continues to change how we get our news. This afternoon, we'll talk with a journalist who has long covered the media about where we are and where we may be headed. Our guest is Alex Jones. He is the author of Losing the News, The Future of the News That Feeds Democracy. Jones asks, what are, quoting here, the values of journalism at a time when those values are increasingly viewed as obsolete or unaffordable in a media world turned upside down by digital technology. He says we're at risk of losing fact-based reporting as we're awash in commodity news, pseudo-news, and news of assertion. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alex S. Jones, our guest, covered the news media for the New York Times from 1983 to 1992 and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for his coverage of the family conflicts and pressures that led to the sale of the Kentucky newspapers, the Courier Journal, and the Louisville Times. Now at Harvard University, Alex Jones is a fourth-generation member of a newspaper-owning family from Greenville, Tennessee. His family continues to own and operate the Greenville Sun. His book, Losing the News, The Future of the News That Feeds Democracy, is published by Oxford University Press. Again, our phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Alex Jones, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
Thank you, Celeste. I'm glad to be with you today.
So how are things at the Greenville Sun these days?
Tough. The Greenville Sun is my family's newspaper. My father's the publisher. He's 94 years old. I have two brothers and a brother-in-law who go to work there every day. And we're having a hard time, but we're determined to carry on and prevail. And we really believe in what we're doing in terms of both a journalistic mission and also as a business, because the business supports the journalistic mission. What I'm concerned about is that we're into an environment in which the journalistic mission is going to be lost because of the economic pressures.
Hmm. Have you seen a decline in the quality of journalism?
I think that the quality of journalism, in a sense, is not the issue in that there are still a huge number of very high qualified, highly motivated, dedicated, determined journalists. In fact, if you've got a journalism job now, you pretty much have to be that. What I think is in jeopardy is the quantity of it, and to a degree the quality of it, because the institutions that are deciding what the journalistic resources are spent on are increasingly geared to spending them on whatever will bring eyeballs and have a criteria for that has more to do with entertainment than importance. That's what I worry about, because a lot of people of course, you know, we're all human, and we tend to be more inclined to entertain ourselves than to do the work of informing ourselves. But if we don't have that mechanism out there for generating that news that informs us about what's going on in government, that watches the mice at play, then we're going to pay the price.
Why do people buy a paper today?
I think that that traditionally people have bought newspapers for a lot of reasons. Some of them bought it for the news. Many of them bought it for a combination of things. They may have been interested in the news, but they may have been even more interested in sports coverage or the crossword puzzle or getting the comics for their kids. The thing is that you bought the whole package, and the whole package was what supported the gathering of the serious news, even though only a percentage of the people who bought the newspaper were really buying it mainly for that purpose. What's happened now in this digital world is that is sort of being broken up. And if you're interested in sports, you can get all sports all the time on the web. I think the thing is that the newspaper business is one that is trying to adjust to a digital world and find a basis for having an enduring business that includes the serious news that only some people want. That's where the difficulty comes, because as the people who have traditionally taken newspapers has declined, the advertising has fallen off, and then, of course, in the economic catastrophe we've been going through, that's been something far, far worse than anybody even expected. I think that what's happening is that newspapers have fewer resources, period, and that's being felt especially hard in the newsroom, especially hard in the newsroom portion of the newsroom that deals with serious political and other what I call iron core news about politics and policy and the kinds of things that inform us as citizens that in ways that we need to be.
You know, we've all heard or read about newsroom layoffs and papers shutting down, and you note that many people are worried but aren't sure what they should be worried about. For people listening to us this afternoon who aren't in this business, what should concern them?
That's a very good question, and that's really the heart of why I wrote this book, because I would, you know, be at dinner with people and we would be discussing the news, and these would be intelligent people who are concerned about the news, but they, I think, had it wrong. In other words, they were concerned about the sort of the bugaboos of bias and that sort of thing, which are always with us and always will be, and are not trivial or unimportant. But what's happening now is something much more profound and something that affects you no matter what your political ideology or persuasion. What I'm talking about in this book is the erosion of the quantity and quality of the kind of fact-based journalism that has been essential to our democracy, in my opinion. And at the same time, what is also in play because of these pressures are the very principles of journalism ethics and objectivity and the sort of institutional power of being able to tell everybody in a community the important news on the front page of a newspaper, which has generally been the place where it's been done. Newspapers represent, in my estimate, about 85% of the reported news in this country. Now, people may read that they get their news from television, but in fact, what they get from television is a delivery system for news, reported news, that has almost certainly been done by a print organization and almost certainly by a newspaper.
One of your concerns is this: shrinkage in the sense of social responsibility on the part of news organizations. What do you see, and what does social responsibility entail?
Well, when the newspaper business became a business was in the latter part of the 19th century, when technology like, you know, fast presses and cheap paper and linotype machines and that kind of thing made it possible to print a lot of newspapers and distribute them. And it became a business. And what happened was that a bargain was struck. The business would be successful because it was selling advertising and selling news to people who wanted it. But it would also have a social mission, and the social mission would be that the newspaper would bear the brunt of the expense of doing the kind of reporting that is something that is identified with high-quality journalism and the kind of coverage of politics and policy that not everyone wants. It was done at about the same time that the journalistic values and norms of objective reporting were being created, which is something also very much in debate with a lot of people feeling one way or the other. I am a supporter of the idea of objective reporting because I think it's more persuasive than any other kind of reporting. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that the newspaper business had from the beginning of this sort of creation as a business, as a serious business, a component that made doing a feeling a social responsibility of representing the public's interest. That was something that was part of the culture of newspapers. Under the economic pressures out there now, as newspapers are struggling to survive, I see this commitment to that public service eroding, and you see newspapers increasingly becoming more like local television, which basically has abandoned that kind of citizenship role because they basically just give people what they want. Well, just giving people what they want is not enough. It's like giving a child just what it wants to eat. You actually need to give the child nourishment as well as something to fill their stomach.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've talked a little bit, or you've talked a little bit about what you call the iron core of news. Let's talk a little bit more about this. What is the iron core of news? What comprises it? And why is it important?
Well, the image that I tried to create was of a of an old and mottled and imperfect cannonball that doesn't look very pretty but is very weighty. And I think of it as the sort of the aggregated sum of all of the serious reported news on serious topics that takes place every day. It's imperfectly done, but it is the weighty essence of what the fact-based conversation that we have as a nation is sort of oriented around. It is not sports news. It is not gossip about Britney Spears. It is not editorials or opinion columns. It is fact-based reported journalism. That is the iron core, as I call it, and it consists of several different kinds of journalism. It consists of simply going and bearing witness to the mayor's press conference or to a war. In its next evolution, it involves following up on that thing to find out whether what the mayor said is actually the truth or not. In the next hierarchy up, it goes to what I would call explanatory journalism, which is a lot of what's going on in the healthcare debate now, with the work being done by serious journalists trying to explain this very complicated situation for the benefit of people who are trying to make up their minds about how they feel. And at the top of that food chain is investigative reporting, which is done in opposition, usually, for someone who is trying to keep you from knowing something. It's very expensive. It takes a lot of expertise and skill and training. That kind of news is what I say is the iron core. And the sum of that iron core is getting lighter. It is eroding like it's being rusted out from within. And that, I think, is very dangerous.
And at the pinnacle of the iron core, investigative journalism is very expensive. Would you talk about that to give our listeners some sense of the funds that are required?
Well, you know, I've known investigations that have cost millions of dollars and have been paid for by news organizations like the Los Angeles Times. Sometimes these investigative efforts can go on for years, and sometimes they start and don't go anywhere, and you can't just publish them because you've spent the money. You have to be honest enough to say we've investigated and there's nothing there. The reason they are expensive is because, one, it takes usually very superior talent to do them, who have the connections and the skill to do them, and often those people are the most highly paid. It takes money because almost always, as I say, they're being done in opposition, and people who don't want you to know things throw up roadblocks, keep the information from you. Often it involves filing lawsuits or freedom of information suits or defending lawsuits that come by people who are trying to keep the information from being released. This takes a lot of money, and it takes a lot of time, a reporter's time, and that costs. So my problem with what's happening is that I think everybody in this country, no matter what they think about the press, agrees that the watchdog role of the press is extremely important. That's something that is genuinely endangered because we have an environment now in which the investigative work that is being done by serious journalists is something that is often now not being done because those journalists aren't there. I'll give you an example. two or three years ago, there was a congressman from California named Duke Cunningham, who was a very powerful congressman on the Appropriations Committee, and it turned out was a complete crook. And two reporters from the San Diego newspaper who were in the bureau in Washington of the San Diego newspaper got on the story, started an investigation, followed it through, exposed him. He's now in jail. And they did a superb journalistic job, won a Pulitzer Prize. Well, now in 2009, that bureau has been abolished. It no longer exists. Those two reporters no longer do the job. And the people of San Diego are much, I feel, the worse off because they don't have people in Washington watching their congressional delegation. I don't think anybody doesn't believe that we need to watch delegations of politicians.
Mm-hmm. Would the not-for-profit model be a model that traditional news organizations could follow?
I think that it can certainly contribute, and I welcome its contribution. As you know, there are some nonprofit organizations that have sprung up and are sort of augmenting what the news organizations have been traditionally doing in terms of investigative reporting and database searches and things like that. The Center for Public Integrity is a terrific one in Washington, and ProPublica is an investigative reporting one. The problem I have with nonprofit as a model, it's something that NPR understands probably only too well, which is that the thing is, funders change their minds. Mm-hmm. People who are generous in one year can have a change in leadership or simply a change of priorities. And it's welcome when you have it, but it is, as far as I can tell, not as reliable as an economically sort of grounded model. So it's not that I am against nonprofit. I am for it, welcome it, and am grateful for it. I think the best solution would be an economic model that is on a business model that works so that it is not, you know, subject to, a foundation simply changing its mind about what it wants to do for the next several years.
How do you go about doing that, building a new business model?
Well, that's what this industry is really trying to do right now. And that's, as I say, what I wrote this book for, because I feel like it's very important that people understand what's happening and what's at stake so they can encourage the news organizations in their communities, their newspapers, and others to devote their energies and their efforts to solving this problem, but on behalf of serious news, not just solve the problem to stay in business, because that really won't accomplish what I'm seeking. What has to happen is they have to find a business that will support that public service mission of reporting this serious kind of news.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Alex S. Jones. He is the author, most recently, of Losing the News, the Future of the News that Feeds Democracy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener on a cell phone in Champaign. Line 4, hi.
Hi, Celeste. A very interesting show. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious to listen to your guest speak because I'm in my 50s and I'm just thinking out loud with the work that Woodward and Bernstein did with Watergate, uncovering that, if that is something that would even be possible today, given the cutbacks and the dilution of the news, it would be very scary to contemplate not being able to get that kind of a story out today. But I'm just wondering if maybe your guest could take a minute and extrapolate things out, where we are with newspapers and their state of affairs, and really the abysmal product that passes for news on TV, where perhaps your guest thinks this whole industry, if you will, might be 5-10 years out. What I'm afraid of is if we get too far away from the core, that there's not going to be a taste for real journalism anymore, and people aren't going to notice it when they see it. And I was just wondering about his comments. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I think that you're right on in every respect. First of all, Woodward and Bernstein, people tend to forget, were a couple of metropolitan reporters. They were not part of some elite investigative team. But they had a news organization that allowed them to pursue the story. And, of course, it made them famous. But when they were doing it, They were attacked. The Nixon White House, of course, went after them hammer and tongs, and the Washington Post stood behind them. Would that happen today? Well, I can tell you that it would be tough, and I hope that the Washington Post and some other great news organizations would back them. But, you know, I can tell you it would be tougher today than it was then, and it wasn't easy then. I think that your point about newspapers is a good one. I think, oddly enough, the economic downturn is perhaps a blessing in disguise for newspapers, because newspapers as an industry had a very, you know, easy time in the 80s and 90s. They made a lot of money and they were rather complacent. And I think that what's happened because of digital technology is that they are going to have to adjust to a new world. And they were rather slow to do that. They had an infrastructure that was built for a different world and a different era and a different level of revenues that was, you know, was realistic. Because of the economic collapse, those revenues have plummeted, and they have had to basically cut their operations to meet a revenue stream that is not what it had been. And I think that's taken a terrible toll in the newsrooms, but it's also taken a toll in other areas of the news organization in the company that probably needed to be taken. I mean, there was probably overhead that needed to be stripped and was difficult and painful to do. We had to do it at my own family's newspapers. It's not easy to do that kind of thing. But I think that now newspapers in this country are, at least most of them, operating at a profit, an operating profit. The ones that are in bankruptcy because of huge debts that they owe. But the operating profit for most newspapers is at least present, modest but present. If the economy, I should say when the economy returns, I'm optimistic that it will, some of that lost advertising revenue will come back. And this is where I think there is a real role for the public, because when that revenue stream starts to come back, newspapers are going to be actually making some money. And the question is, how are they going to spend that money? It's extremely important for their long-term survival, as far as I'm concerned, that they spend that money rehiring and bolstering that journalism strength that they have let go in these past several years. And I think it's going to be very important for people. And if I were telling you what I wish you would do out there, I would say hold your nose and subscribe to your newspaper, even if you feel like it's not doing what it should. And then write a letter to the editor of the newspaper, literally write a letter to the editor and say, look, I'm a customer. I'm paying for the newspaper. I want you to give me the news. I want the news if you want to keep me. That is something I think actually could have a tremendous impact on how newspapers go about trying to figure out what their role is going to be in this world of morning. Now, what that world is going to be, I don't think any of us know right now. But I think for newspapers, there's a chance. And I think it is really important for communities, for news, for journalism, that newspapers as institutions survive, both in a digital form and, I think, for a while to come, on paper. So I hope people will be engaged enough to demand that kind of news. They are not going to get it, I think, on television. You raised the issue of television, and I think that all of us are very disappointed in the quality of news on cable television, especially in recent years, become so overheatedly abusive and vitriolic that trying to get information is very difficult. One of the things that I try to stress in this book is that we need to have the national conversation, but what we're going to have if we lose this iron core of news is something that you can think of as nothing but the sort of hot air and vitriol that you see on cable television now, with half-truths and semi-truths and propaganda and pseudo-news and public relations and all that sort of thing, instead of the facts that you can trust. That is the essential for the democratic mission of journalism, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign waiting for us on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I take the local paper, the Champaign News Gazette, and read it daily. But I also read the New York Times online pretty much daily. I've never sent them a penny. And I wonder how long can they sustain being on the net at no charge. How do they do this, and can it last, was my question.
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that the whole industry is wrestling with. The problem is this. The newspaper business has been funded mostly by advertising in its print product, and it continues to be. That's the engine, even at the New York Times, for most of its revenues. The cost of subscriptions was about 20% of the total revenue stream. The problem with charging people for online delivery is that because the culture of the web is so powerfully to be free, an awful lot of people who read the New York Times online and make it the most visited newspaper website that there is would go somewhere else probably because it was free. And because of that, the number of eyeballs would go down, and hypothetically, the value of the advertising to advertisers would go down. Advertising online has not been nearly as profitable, so far anyway, as advertising in print. If you can find a way to match the revenues with online advertising that will pay, you know, for the kind of news that the New York Times does, that would be great. But I think that journalism, you know, and the news organizations that are trying to sort of figure this out have to calculate what happens when you start charging if your views go down and the revenue stream from your online advertising takes a tank. They haven't figured it out yet, I can tell you. There's an awful lot of people who say, well, we've got to charge. On the other hand, I haven't seen anyone leap into that, although some people say they're going to.
Yeah. So a listener want to follow up?
No, I knew that question was beyond me, and it sounds like they're still guessing, too. So thank you very much.
I'm afraid you're right.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Here's a question, too, and it's something that you write about in Losing the News, is that, you know, newspaper websites, you know, who is reading them? Who's using them? Are they people like you and me and the caller who are reading a daily paper? You know, are people who are out there doing all kinds of social networking, are they looking at newspaper websites?
Well, you know, this is an interesting point, too. Looking at a website means all kinds of things. If you look at a website and you go to the most viewed list, do you get the most important news or do you get the most popular, interesting, entertaining news? If you, like I, have the New York Times and the Boston Globe on my doorstep every morning, you know, in paper, and I read them there, that's my pleasure every morning with a cup of coffee in the newspaper, which I am sort of fancifully believe will be rediscovered, like the value and pleasure of dry martinis by a new generation eventually. I also check the New York Times website, you know, several times a day to see if anything new is happening and what's going on. I think the thing is a lot of people who are interested in news obviously go to the New York Times website. But would they continue to go to the New York Times website if they had to pay for it? I think that the jury is out on that. Some would. Would enough to create an elite, valuable enough audience that the New York Times could then charge advertisers significantly for the right to advertise next to the stories that these people have decided to queue up? I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure the New York Times would like to have a satisfying answer to it themselves. So far, the New York Times has essentially made the judgment that it was worth more to the Times to be the most visited site than the one that has, like the Wall Street Journal, a separate source of revenues from charging.
It seems to me that a paper like the New York Times, in being both a paper and an online delivery of news, is that it's asking its reporters and editors to do a lot more.
I think this is one of the worst aspects of what's happening. And one of the solutions, as far as I'm concerned, is to let reporters be reporters in a genre. And this is something that's being faced by the, you know, public radio, I know, because you guys are trying to figure out what you're going to be on the web. Mm-hmm. I believe, just as with newspapers, that radio is a medium that has its own huge demands to do very well, just like television. And I think that for television reporters to be expected to be at NPR levels of radio production, news production. It would be as crazy as to think that radio reporters would be writing stories that could appear on the New York Times. I don't think it makes good sense. But I think increasingly, because of economic pressures, reporters are being forced to file in all kinds of different ways. And believe me, I speak as a former reporter. That takes away from the time that you can spend checking stories, finding new information, vetting, doing the things that that reporters really need to be spending their time doing.
Yeah. It's interesting. Here in this building, we're very much engaged in this conversation, this discussion right now. We're talking about content and platforms and community engagement and social responsibility. And we're at work trying to figure it all out. And I suspect this is happening across the media landscape. And I think maybe that's a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing to have the conversation. But I'll tell you, I guess maybe I'm prejudiced because I was the host of a radio program in New York called called On the Media, which I loved doing and came to really appreciate the power and the singularity of radio as a medium. And I think that for radio to be radio is a great challenge. To be the very best radio is something that should satisfy what radio wants to be. That doesn't mean you don't have an online presence, but I'm saying that I believe that there is an error in trying to be all things to all people when it comes to crossing the genres. Personally, that's the way I look at it. I think that radio is a difficult thing to do well. I do understand that. And I think that, you know, asking radio reporters to also be videographers and write their stories in print form and so forth like that is going to dilute the best of what you do.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Alex S. Jones, the author most recently of Losing the News, The Future of the News That Feeds Democracy. Our guest covered the news media for The New York Times from 1983 to 1992 and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us here this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a statistic you cite in Losing the News. Newspaper believability dropped to 54% in 2005 from 84% in 1984. That comes from the Pew Research Center for People in the Press. What do you think is responsible for this lack of confidence in newspapers?
Well, I think we have to start with newspapers themselves. I think that it would be naive and wrong to blame this on any, you know, outside forces, because I think that the essential problem has been that newspapers lost the confidence of people because people came to believe that they were not getting the straight stuff. I think there's been a lot of, you know, phony objectivity and things like that that have contributed to this. But on the other hand, I think it's also true that newspapers and news organizations that are represented in that statistic also get a bad rap in this respect. First of all, they were the object of a rabid campaign by conservatives to discredit anything that was not according to the party line as biased. I think that the words bias and newspapers became almost synonyms as far as a lot of people in the United States were concerned. Certainly they heard it an awful lot and continue to hear it an awful lot. And I think it's also true that when people are told something that they don't agree with, they tend to view that as something that is unbelievable. And I think that it takes a lot of patience and belief to persuade people that what they're getting is the straight stuff. But I do believe that the standard of objectivity, correctly interpreted, is an effort to tell as a practical truth, not a sort of theoretical idealized truth, but a practical truth which is the most truthful, the most honest way of explaining something that a reporter is able to find out. And I think it was that kind of reporting that changed people's minds about, for instance, the Iraq War. because when the Iraq War started, an awful lot of Americans believed what they had been told and were in favor of the war. They changed their minds because journalists on the ground, at great risk and an enormous expense, persuaded them over time that the truth of what was happening was different than what they had been told. That is not to say that, well, what I mean is that it was not people railing on the left or the right and giving their opinions. It was to change a mind. I believe you have to persuade people that the truth is other than what they thought. And I don't believe that, that subjective reporting and sort of commentary is the mechanism for doing that. I think it's facts on the ground that people, even reluctantly, come to believe is the truth, is the most persuasive way to change a mind. Maybe commentary and public relations and sort of advocacy journalism is a very good way to persuade people that what they already think is the truth, but it's not a great way to change minds.
How good are we at seeing quality journalism and, you know, seeing the chaff for the wheat?
Well, I think that that's one of the problems of brands. I tend to believe in brands. I think that that doesn't mean that you are blinkered or that you don't recognize that in any news organization there are going to be terrible errors. I'm prejudiced because of my time at the New York Times. I know that that institution is one that takes itself and its mission very, very seriously and also has upon occasion screwed up horribly, but has had, I believe, to its credit, the guts to acknowledge its errors and to, be transparent about what happened. I don't think you'll find that in many other institutions. But oddly enough, I think that because newspapers have been more transparent and more willing to admit their errors than any others, it is oddly enough given them less credibility instead of more because they talk about their errors more than doctors and lawyers and just about anybody else. I think as far as quality is concerned, obviously you don't suspend disbelief, but you give benefit of the doubt if you believe that the institution has standards that it is trying to live up to and honor. And I believe that that is more true with organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal than it is with, many, many other institutions that I can think of. I, for instance, do not really take seriously what I see or hear on cable news now because I don't know where they're coming from at all.
In past periods of great upheaval in media, we saw, for example, we saw consolidation in the newspaper business. We saw the coming of radio and then television. Is what we're in now different, and if so, how?
I think it is different because I think that digital technology changes everything. I mean, digital technology really is changing, is an economic watershed moment, not unlike the invention of the Gutenberg Bible or the invention of the telegraph, which the telegraph really was the sort of signature moment for the creation of news as we know it because it collapsed for the first time the limits of time and distance because you could find out what was happening far away relatively quickly. And the Gutenberg Bible, the Gutenberg Press, I should say. The Bible was just the product of it. The Gutenberg Press allowed for a number allowed for broadcasting, if you will, for the first time. It allowed, one press to create a kind of a volume of information that could be spread. Well, what's happened now with digital technology is just as transformational, but in the opposite direction. It is, on the one hand, a mechanism for communication that is unmatched in the history of the world, but it has also made it very much not the case of broadcasting, but of narrowcasting in the very most narrow kind of way, because every individual can, be his own news organization. Every individual tailors what he finds or doesn't find on the web entirely to his own tastes, And I think that the segmentation of news of every kind, I mean, the news in the web world is not just narrowly things like if you're interested in sports, you go to sports. You can go to, you know, the most arcane kinds of narrow focuses. That is something that we've never had before. And we've got now, given the human, you know, willingness and desire to be entertained and distracted, we've got in the web the most incredible engine for doing both of those things that's ever been invented in the history of mankind. And we're doing things now that are, you know, I don't know quite what to make of what the world is going to be like if, as I think a lot of people are now doing, we spend a great amount of our time in a virtual world, a virtual reality that really is not having to do with anything involving politics or policy or even, the local baseball team, but is a fantasy world. We can do that now, and increasingly people are doing it. Millions of people are doing it.
Yeah. Maybe what we need to do is to become better editors for ourselves.
Well, I think that we certainly have to assume that role to a degree, because you have the choice of where you devote your attention and where you spend your time, invest your time, because the web is infinite in its opportunities to, you know, spend that time and the alternatives that you have. It reminds me sometimes of being presented with the most incredibly lavish smorgasbord of imaginable, with every kind of food of every ethnic variety of all qualities there. And, you know, you're presented with this ballroom of choices. So what do you choose? Do you choose steamed broccoli? Well, my wife would, but I'm not sure anyone else would.
Yeah. Maybe a little meat, a little potatoes, a little steamed broccoli, and a big piece of cake.
Well, you want some of everything. Yeah. But I think that, increasingly, you know, we are a nation that is inclined to indulge. And I think that you can, you know, look at the statistics on being overweight. I think we tend to be, you know, a people that are inclined to feed ourselves in not the smartest way. And I think that that's also true of the way we inform ourselves. You have to take some responsibility now to inform yourself, to be an informed citizen. But you also have to have the means of doing that, which I think is also, you know, critically important. But I don't disagree. I think we've got to be our own editors, but we've got to have the information out there. Ironically, even if people aren't willing to consume important news themselves, most of us really want somebody to be out there watching the store, whether we're going to read the articles or not. That's in jeopardy now.
It's also interesting, and this was something fun to think about when I was reading Losing the News, is that all across the culture, this iron core is important. And you mention Jay Leno.
Absolutely.
Think about The Daily Show. Think about Colbert.
No, they are derivative of the iron core of news. And the problem is, if we don't have an iron core, what we'll have instead is, you know, public relations and advocacy and assertion without factual basis. We've seen so much of that in this healthcare debate. It's really terrifying in a way to see how powerful something that is simply not true can become, as far as a lot of people are concerned, simply because it's being said. That is why you need a fact-based backup to say, wait a minute, this is what the facts are.
Let's take one last call this afternoon. A listener in Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Thank you. Speaking of editors, we had the matter of owners, like Catherine Graham and Bradley, who at that time were open to handling the Pentagon Papers. And, of course, Woodward and Bernstein and others who were notable. But then it seems as though that the format of the newspapers, being able to cover everything, investigative journalism, so forth, has evolved into the magazines are picking up the gauntlet and publishing articles that couldn't get their backing or expose in the paper, depending upon who owns the paper and who's the noise machine they're pumping, you know. So I thought I'd offer that matter of the importance of the ownership and the open and freedom that the right persons can allow. Thank you.
I think your caller has said something very important, it actually always is going to come down to who the owners are. My family has owned this newspaper, as you noted, in a little town called Greenville, Tennessee, in East Tennessee in the Smoky Mountain area. We've been there since 1916. And I believe that we try to run that newspaper from the perspective of doing a service to our community, that is really an important part of what we're doing, and we really try to honor that commitment. And I think if it doesn't come from the owners, it's not going to be there, probably, because the people in the newsrooms are going to be responsive to the guidance from the owners. One of the problems we have right now is one of leadership, and leadership that is geared toward recognizing the importance of this public service mission. I believe it's not only important as an obligation to the public, but I believe it is critical to the economic survival of these news organizations, that to the extent they do it and are recognized as doing it, they will have a chance of succeeding and surviving. To the extent they don't, I think people are going to say, I just don't need it, and it doesn't do anything for our community, so why?
Hmm. Alex Jones, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Glad to be with you, Celeste.
Alex S. Jones covered the news media for the New York Times from 1983 to 1992 and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. Now at Harvard University, his latest book is Losing the News, The Future of the News That Feeds Democracy. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.